nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Okay, so ready? Okay. All right, so today we're going to introduce finite difference time domain simulations, which I've alluded to a few times before. So you remember on Monday, we talked about solving ordinary differential equations and basically two specific classes, like initial value problems, for example, could be like the couple mode theory equations, and then boundary value problems, which are more closely related to what we'll look at today. We spoke about a specific example, the NanoHub tool called CMTComb3, and kind of explained like why do we care about these optical frequency combs, which are generated by four-wave mixing, how they can be described kind of in a compact fashion. That's less computationally intensive than a full 3D finite difference time domain simulation, as we'll see in a minute. And then we showed the user interface and the output. Okay. So today, like when we talk about finite difference time domain, this is going to lead directly into discussion of a tool that I developed or co-developed when I was at MIT called MEEP. And here are some of the specific features that we'll see kind of showing up in MEEP, perfectly matched layers, which is also something we saw in the finite element method. Subpixel averaging, which helps improve the accuracy of the results without increasing the computational load. Symmetry operations to basically reduce the effective domain size, and then programmable interface. And then we'll show how this can be applied to like a few specific problems related to light trapping. Okay, so first things first. So you probably feel like you already know Maxwell's equations. And so what I'm going to tell you right now is that actually we're going to change them. So, and you may be wondering, why am I changing Maxwell's equations? That seems rather odd. So the reason is because of the perfectly matched layer condition. So certainly in optics, we know Faraday's law, dB dt equals minus curl E, right? And then we know Ampere's law, basically curl H equals J, and then Maxwell's correction, which is dd dt in this notation. However, things that are not necessarily as common are, for example, adding in this conductivity term, this sigma d times capital D displacement field. Okay, so this represents material absorption, okay? But then this has actually a dual role, because at the outer edges of our computational domain, which I'll explain in more detail in a minute, then we're going to have, no matter what the actual structure is here, okay, so let's say that this is some photonic crystal with a finite area, okay? So let's say it just looks like this. Then let's say that this is not absorptive at all. When we have a source emitting here, we want to propagate Maxwell's equations, basically Faraday's law and Ampere's law with Maxwell's correction. We want to propagate those, and maybe sigma d equals zero in this region. However, we want to basically track what's emitted over here, and then what's emitted to here, emitted to here. So that's basically like saying, what is the Green's function or a transfer function between two points in space with specific set of polarizations, okay? Now, the problem is that if we have like some like finite domain, which obviously we have to because we only have a finite amount of computational resources, then it's quite likely that if we don't choose the boundary conditions correctly, then maybe we'll emit some wave like this, and then it will bounce right back. Okay, so that's probably bad, because if we have our waves bouncing back, then we won't be able to necessarily tell what was coming directly from the source and then what was just the reflection. Especially if the source is like has a long time to turn on. Okay. So This is where the sigma D on the edges comes into play. Okay. So here we basically say that in this boundary region, which is going to be the perfectly matched layers, then we're going to introduce sigma D in absorption not equal to zero. Now, it would be nice if that's all we had to do. If we just have like some finite absorption and conductivity, then we just absorb it and then we're done. However, that doesn't always work, because basically what happens is we can potentially have an impedance mismatch. So you know that the impedance of free space is different from like a dielectric medium of index n. Okay. And then also if you have a mismatch in terms of the effective imaginary refractive index, which is closely linked to conductivity, then again you have the same potential for reflection, even if you have like something that would otherwise absorb very strongly. Okay. So then there are two things you have to do. First of all, you have to have some sort of gradient of sigma D. So sigma D is actually going to increase according to some polynomial. So now we're going to say sigma D is like, let's say x minus xl. If we say that this is like the edge coordinate xl, this is x0, and then to some power. And then we'll just call this some integer m. And then presumably m is greater than zero. Okay. So, I mean, there are actually multiple choices that we can use, and I'll show you in a minute, like, what happens in different scenarios. Right. So, it might make sense to pick m equals 2 or m equals 4. Or maybe even higher numbers. Probably doesn't make sense to pick m equals 10,000. Yes.
Yeah, this is sigma D.
Yeah.
Material absorption.
Right.
What is the physical medium, and also what is the dimension?
Okay. So, as you know, you can usually write Ohm's law if you're a physicist in this form, J equals sigma E. Right. And then this is roughly speaking equal to, like, I equals GV. Okay, so these two are closely related to one another, like in the electrical engineering notation, right? And then this sigma is going to have dimensions, obviously depending on the units that you're employing. So I've tried to be fairly agnostic about units up to this point, and as you'll see, in MEEP, everything's done in dimensionless units. However, the kind of the SI version of this would be that sigma is equal to the current, which is like kind of a, it's like a current per unit area, so like amps per meter squared, divided by the E, right? And the E field is usually in volts per meter. So then you get something like sigma in terms of amps per volts, right? And so it kind of makes sense, like if you write I over V, then that's like inverse of resistance. So that's like Siemens. So that's like Siemens, and then per meter squared, and then times meter. So Siemens per meter, as you can see.
Well, in this place, we have like, in the second equation, we have dd dt.
Uh-huh.
So there is like d over t, for example, to non-dimensionalize them. And we have sigma times d. So it looks like sigma has the dimension of 1 over time. I mean, sigma sub d has the dimension of 1 over time.
Okay.
Does it become correct?
Okay, so the point here is that I've written this in a dimensionless format. So I'm not saying that this is written in SI units.
Okay.
No, I guess your question is, like, how do you, like, compare this to experiment? Is that the question? Like, I guess, what's the reason you're asking about units?
Yeah, one question. I'm just trying to see if this, if the dimension is okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the point is that the the dimensions are chosen specifically to be dimensionless, right? So all of these like conversion factors are kind of hidden in this formulation, because the emphasis in this formulation, like the way that I've written Maxwell's equations, is just on looking at the physics instead of trying to necessarily directly compare to experiment right away. And so then the advantage of this approach is that this will give us like a more natural way to kind of develop the FTTD formulation without having to worry about like having stuff in like units of volts per meter all the time. And then at the end, when we come back to this, then we'll actually try to look at how do we connect this physically to an experiment. Is that okay? So I realized that, you know, maybe for electrical engineering department, this is unusual approach, because this is like very like theoretical physics type approach compared to just like kind of writing down the exact equations that are directly comparable to experiment at every step. So, but I wanted to also add that there's this other term, okay, here. And so then this is where it really starts to deviate from experiments, okay? Because what this term here represents is something that's analogous to what we normally think of as conductivity from Ohm's law, but for magnetic fields. So this is basically postulating a magnetic version of Ohm's law, which involves like a magnetic conductivity. Okay, so as you guys probably realize, like that doesn't exist, because that basically requires magnetic monopoles to be even possible, which are analogous to like electrons or holes. Okay, as far as I know, they don't exist. There have been some postulation that maybe they exist based on like some work by Dirac a long time ago, but assuming for the moment that this is just fictitious, the reason why we're introducing this is because we need to deal with that impedance mismatch more comprehensively than just basically like introduce like a very slow gradient in sigma d. So this will allow us to have like very strong absorption for all angles and all polarizations. So now we're going to have both the sigma d and the sigma b at the same time. And then this will also have a similar power law scaling as we move into this region. And the thing here is that all of the sigmas in this region, we're assuming for this example, are zero. Now, sigma d in general can be non-zero, but we never allow sigma b to be non-zero inside our actual physically computed fields. And so the argument of perfectly matched layers is that when light enters into those regions, because like they're designed to not reflect anything, then it won't adversely affect the physical accuracy of what's obtained inside of the computational domain. However, the fields that are obtained in this region cannot be directly compared to any experiments because magnetic monopoles don't exist. So does that general premise make sense? Yes, Roman.
So why do we actually need this magnetic?
Why do we need it?
Because yeah. It seems that using the CCMD will take care of reducing the magnitude of the electric field, which results in reduction of the magnetic field by itself.
Yeah. So I think the point about just doing sigma d is that if you try that, it's very difficult to get that to work for all angles and all polarizations and multiple wavelengths all at the same time. Now, in certain situations, then you could probably just say sigma b is zero, and then maybe this would work, right? But if you want like a general solution that can be proven to always work, then you actually need to have both. So, yeah, that is like obviously a significant concern. And this whole area of like perfectly matched layers took a long time to play out, because like there have been a few different formulations which were initially extremely awkward and now not, maybe not quite as awkward, but there are still like obviously important questions you have to ask about, like, what is the actual physics being computed? Is there any like inaccuracy associated with this and so on? And so my argument, which I've only asserted and not really proven, is that introducing this in the outer regions correctly will not disrupt the physical solution inside. So we'll see more of that later. And I mean, I assumed you already knew these auxiliary functions, but just for the sake of completeness, just want to emphasize that here, you know, again, because we've kind of made the units as simple as possible, epsilon is just n squared, so there's no units associated with epsilon either. Okay, and then same for mu. So how are we going to solve these equations, right? So based on the name, it's time domain simulation. We're going to start at time t equals 0 and then proceed to some other time greater than 0, presumably, right? And we're going to need initial conditions for all of the electric and magnetic fields in our problem. But actually, at a fundamental level, we might want to ask, how can we accurately step these electric and magnetic fields through time? Okay, like in all points in space. And so if you remember when we talked about ODE solutions, we said there are a few different approaches. We said Euler method is not very reliable, right? So we probably don't want to use the Euler method. However, there's also something that was not that more complicated than the Euler method, which we called the leapfrog method. And we said the leapfrog method is more accurate. So what is the leapfrog method again? So just to recap briefly, we said that you basically alternate solving like two halves of like your overall problem in time. We said initially it was just an ODE, so the only independent variable was time. But now we have independent variables of time and space. So the logical extension is that we alternate solving E fields and H fields, which are kind of like the two halves of our solution in both space and time at the same time. Okay. And so then this basic concept is what gives rise to the E lattice. And then this is just an illustration of what does the E lattice look like. So roughly speaking, what you see here is that within each like grid point, while of course, like in your memory, you represent like each of these fields like as being associated with its grid point. You kind of assume that there's a specific point in space that's like kind of a specific 3D position relative to the center of the grid point that each field has associated with it, right? So, for example, EX is like kind of in the X direction, okay, pointing in the X direction and along this edge that goes from like X equals 0 to X equals grid spacing. Same for Y, and then same for Z, okay? Now the H fields are offset, so they're kind of like staggered by, you see that the HC field, of course, is kind of in the middle of this XY face. The HX is in the middle of the YZ face, and then HY on the XC face. Okay, so while the E fields are associated with the edges of their components, the H fields are like kind of on the faces that are opposite to their components. So I hope that is easy to remember or makes sense to you. Okay. And so why did we choose it that way? Well, basically, like, because this set of choices allows us to get a fairly accurate leapfrog integration. Okay. Which is going to give us like 1 over delta t squared type accuracy, or 1 over delta x squared, if you want to think about it that way. And you can show that there's no error up to 1 over delta t squared. And so then all the errors will be higher order. And there have been many implementations of this basic algorithm, because this was first looked at by Yi in 1966, I believe. This basic paradigm was incorporated into the Taflov and Hagness book and many other books. And this is, of course, also covered in Obaya and in the Joannopoulos book. It's alluded to briefly. And then it's implemented also in MEEP. And the reason why I mention MEEP here is because it's a freely available simulator that has a lot of cool features. Yep.
The accuracy is proportional to 1 over inverse delta time squared.
Yeah.
So you want the delta t to be small or large?
Well, it depends. Okay, so this is just, I guess, semantic issue. But if you want to say, like, what is the amplitude of the error goes as, like, the grid spacing squared, right? So you reduce the grid spacing by a factor of 2. Now the error's gone down to a factor of 4. But I guess, like, I defined an accuracy as the inverse of an error, and then that gives us, like, a 1 over delta t squared. So I guess it just depends on your perspective. So I could also say error goes as delta t squared, but that doesn't sound as good. Okay. Does that make sense? Yes, Roman.
I'm not sure if you allude to this further on, but what's the order that modification takes place? And does it change actually the results if we choose different order in which we...
You mean evaluating E versus H?
Exactly.
Yeah, so generally speaking, you start off with all of the E fields defined at t equals 0. So, I'll talk about that now, actually. So if you don't mind, I'll erase this. And we'll go back to this set of equations, okay? So we'll start off with all the E fields defined at t equals 0. And then we're going to try to time step them, okay? So, what that means is if we already know our initial conditions, okay, so say we have a bunch of E equal to 0, okay, for all X, and I should probably rewrite this, sorry. So say E of X T equals 0 for all X. Okay, so that just means we have an empty field to start off with, okay? And then we also have, like, some J, which turns on, like, E to the minus, we can say T minus T naught squared divided by sigma T squared times E to the minus J omega naught T. Okay, so this basically is like a Gaussian envelope. So we basically have like this current, which follows this Gaussian envelope. The carrier frequency you can see is omega naught, and so then the distance between these from peak to peak is going to go like 2 pi over omega naught. That's your period. And then this kind of overall width, like for like decay, is going to be like a sigma t. And then this is like our t naught, like the point at which this amplitude is at a maximum. Okay. And so what we're going to say is that we have this dB by dt of minus curl E and minus JB, okay? And we're going to assume for the time being that we can ignore this fictitious magnetic conductivity. Okay, so then we can basically rewrite this as like a delta B equal to delta T times minus curl of E minus JB. Okay, so then basically using these initial conditions and this like kind of preset like time dependence for the current, then we can plug that in at t equals zero and then use delta t to be one half of like a full time step. Okay, so if we say delta t full divided by two, then this will start to give us the B fields like at points that are incremented by half a time step, right? So then this will give us B is equal to B naught, which presumably is zero as well. So I'll add this as another initial condition. So we'll say B at t equals one half is going to be like delta t f over 2 added to 0 times this is 0 at t equals 0 and then minus jb. Okay, so then that's going to be this term evaluated at e to the minus t naught squared over sigma t squared. And then this was 0, so that drops out. Okay. So that gives us an initial magnetic field at a half time step, okay? And then we're going to go back to Ampere's law with Maxwell's correction, rather. And then we'll say dd dt is equal to minus curl h minus j. So this JB should also be zero. So I should just set this equal to zero. What I meant to do is update it here. So then we should get that D at T equals one is going to be equal to minus delta T times curl of H, which is still zero, and then minus this j, which is like e to the minus t equal to 1 minus t naught squared divided by sigma t squared e to the minus j omega naught t, which is 1. Okay. So the jb is the fictitious current. Okay, so we can drop that for the time being. Okay, so the point is, once we have this D, then we'll go back to the original equation here for Faraday's law, and then we'll evaluate at T equals 3/2, and then we just kind of alternate back and forth between evaluating these two. And so the other reason you can see for like why we have an offset between these two like sets of fields is that in both cases we're taking curls. And so in order to take a curl, it's actually appropriate to kind of do this spatial averaging over these different E field positions in order to get like, basically if you take a curl and you want to find the Z component of the E field, right? Then you're going to, as you probably remember, you can write that curl of E is equal to like something that's like a determinant, which is like X hat, Y hat, Z hat, and then D by DX, D by DY, D by DZ, EX, EY, EZ. Okay. And then to find the Z component, then you basically take expansion by minors of this part, and then you get z hat times dx by ey minus dy by ex. So that becomes dx ey minus dy ex. Okay, so you have to take the derivative of EY in the X direction, right? So then the way that this is set up, you can take the derivative by basically subtracting these two and then dividing by this grid spacing. Okay, so this is actually very straightforward. And this will give you a result that in principle should be located right at this position. And then similarly, when you take the y derivative with respect to ex, then that'll also give us like kind of this average between the difference between these two divided by the spacing. Okay, so you can see how like the contribution to hc actually ends up being exactly where we expect it to be or need it to be based on the positions of the E's. And then the reverse holds true when we're trying to take the curl of the H fields as well. So I hope that makes sense. Does that make sense? Okay. So that's basically the procedure. I think that like all the equations are contained in multiple locations like Taffel's book. I should probably add some more references here just for the sake of completeness. But Obeya chapter 5 talks about this. And then I said Taflov, and I think Yi's original paper does. Now, the problem is, like, if you look at a lot of textbooks, they have, like, very awkward notation for everything. So it's not actually always that easy to figure out what's going on by reading the equations directly. So I think it's more important to have insight into, like, you know, what are they doing and why are they doing it, rather than to, for example, try to memorize those equations. I just don't think that's going to be a good use of your time. All right, so hopefully the basic algorithm is kind of makes sense so far. So the next thing is that you have to figure out, like, what kind of step sizes are you allowed to use, okay? Because, like, you might say, you know, like, why don't we just, like, evaluate this in one time step and then we're done, right? That would be nice. it would run very fast in that case. But unfortunately, you can't just do arbitrarily fast solution in arbitrarily small number of time steps. And so, like, there's a way to kind of, like, systematically address this issue. So in the area of, like, partial differential equations, which, of course, Maxwell's equations are an example of, then there's this kind of canonical assumption you have to make in all your methods that you develop, which is that any error that's introduced as a result of discretization is bounded after infinite amount of time. Okay, so that, in other words, means that you do not allow exponentially growing solutions, because presumably that would not be a physically realistic solution. Okay, so that's basically like a numerical assumption which comes in from the physics of most problems. Now, if for some reason you really want to simulate that, then maybe this doesn't apply, but I kind of doubt most people want exponentially growing solutions forever. Okay. So, and certainly not like in Maxwell's equations. So basically, like, this is oftentimes called von Neumann stability analysis, although I've seen other terms for it. And it is covered in numerical recipes, like one of the later chapters, probably 19. And so effectively, what this consists of is you kind of go back to this set of iterations or time steps, and then you look at what is the comparison in the inaccuracy when you look at, like, I guess, delta t and then the delta x. And so, like I said, the goal is to assume that you won't have exponentially growing errors in your solution. And so if you say that we have, like, this delta b here, so we can say that b equals b naught plus delta b in general. And then we can rewrite this as, like, kind of the first two terms of a Taylor expansion, delta b over b naught. And then if we kind of pessimistically assume that this was going to be some kind of exponentially growing solution, then we'd write something like B is equal to B naught times E to the delta B over B naught. So what that tells us is if delta B is positive in general, then we're going to have the solution blow up, okay? So I think, like, if you look at this step, then this is pretty much always going to be stable. But then this step could potentially be unstable for D. And so as we saw before, like, we have this delta T, which comes up here. So then we get a delta D equal to delta T times this curl operator, which will ultimately depend on 1 over delta X, for example, if we're taking, like, the Y or Z component, times, like, a difference in adjacent fields. Like, so maybe HY at position 1 versus HY at position 2, something like that. And when we compare this to the J, the current that's being introduced into the system, then we need this term to be smaller than some maximum value. And so usually we can say that the maximum value here is like some constant, okay? So delta T over delta X must be less than constant, okay? So usually we say that because of the dimensions of this, that even though I said everything was dimensionless, because it's like in these units of time and position in general, then we're going to say that this is like inverse velocity. And so then that generally means that we'll have a delta X over delta T must be less than or equal to some speed C. Okay. But then because like this is a 3D evaluation and I only did like kind of the 1D calculation, then there's a correction of 1 over square root of the number of dimensions. So, sorry, I wrote this wrong. So we must have 1 over square root of D times delta X over delta T must be greater than or equal to the speed of light. So in other words, the speed of light must be strictly constrained in order to prevent it from basically causing exponentially growing solutions. Right. And so the point is that if you violate this condition, which is usually called the Courant condition, then you could potentially end up with completely unphysical, exponentially growing solutions. And this is even in the absence of any absorption or like gain media. Okay. Just because like you didn't solve it in a stable fashion. And so usually, if you set delta X and delta T to be 1 or like some like grid spacing, okay, then usually you can say that C is less than or equal to 1 over root 3. And then that gives you an answer like 0.577 or something. So it's usually easier just to say C equals 1/2. So you're safely within like the Courant stability regime. So does this kind of basic explanation make sense, I hope? And then, unfortunately, oh, sorry, what's your question?
Is the equality still stable?
So in principle, it should be, but I think people like to set it slightly below that exact value because, like, this is an irrational number in 3D. So you can't, like, truly be exactly on an irrational number in a normal computer. I mean, I mean, maybe like there's a geometric way to do that, but I think like the way most computers are constructed, you just can't exactly hit this 1/√3 in terms of the propagation speed. So in practice, you're always like a finite amount below it. Yeah, I'm saying in 1D, that might be okay. So I think you're right. That 1D is probably okay, but 3D, I think C equals 1/2 is very common choice. And the argument is that, like, maybe you're sacrificing a tiny amount in speed, but like the simplicity and stability are greatly enhanced. So that more than makes up for like maybe a 10% performance degradation. But if you want it to be really aggressive, you could set it to like something that's just like a machine precision below what you evaluate this at and then see what happens. That would be interesting, actually. I haven't tried that. So, okay. So basically, this is just a specific example of the von Neumann stability analysis. And I think it's like explained in much more comprehensive way by numerical recipes. Okay, so now that we kind of established like what are the fundamental building blocks of FTTD, then I'll talk about some of like what are the cool features that MEEP has to offer. Okay, and of course I don't have a lot of time to explain everything, so I'll try to be brief. So this is the list, okay, and I'm not going to actually talk about everything today, certainly. But one thing, of course, is that it can do 1D, 2D, and 3D problems. And there's no like need to like get a new solver for each dimensionality, which is good. And it can accommodate a wide variety of boundary conditions, including perfectly matched layers, but also like perfect electrical conductors or periodic boundary conditions and so on. It also has the subpixel averaging, which I mentioned before. I'll hopefully explain that in more detail. Has symmetry to kind of speed up problems and parallelization to split the load across many processors, which is important because like nowadays, even laptops have multi-cores, so you better make use of that. And it's programmable, like it uses a real programming language. It also has some advanced features that a lot of you would never use probably, including nonlinear insatiable gain media and a frequency domain solver. Okay, so PML. So remember before I was talking about like what is the kind of the form as a power law of the sigma D and sigma B in the perfectly matched layer region on the outside. And so here basically we're just showing how the error converges as you modify the absorber length in the PML region. Okay, so what you see is actually, even if you just have a linear ramp upwards, it actually converges pretty quickly as you increase the thickness of the PML region, which is depicted here. Okay, but it looks like actually the best choices are either quadratic or cubic based on this graph, right? And so cubic actually converges like 1/(L^10) power. So, you know, this is actually pretty good. And then this is also another test. I think this was in cylindrical coordinates, if I remember correctly. So, but in like both Cartesian and cylindrical coordinates, you have pretty good convergence based on like cubic. The left one? Yeah, maybe you're right. Yeah. This is probably cylindrical. I guess like the convergence is really good in both cases. So it's, I think you're right just based on the field profiles. And oh, there's RZ. Yeah. So this is definitely cylindrical. Thank you, Eugene. Okay. Okay. So now, let me mention the subpixel averaging. So what's the point of this? Like basically the argument is that when you have like some sort of interface, and you have like this grid discretization of that interface. If this doesn't neatly fall along the grid boundary lines, then you won't necessarily like be able to just like use kind of a naive average of like the high dielectric above, or sorry, below, and then low dielectric above, right? So what may be better is to pick kind of an average that incorporates like the geometry of the interface, like kind of the angle at which it exists, so that you can have different boundary conditions, basically anisotropic dielectric tensor representing the grid. And so the argument for doing that is that that would more accurately reflect kind of the boundary conditions that are associated with Maxwell's equations. And so, for example, that would, if you chose that anisotropic dielectric tensor correctly, that would give you a continuous d perpendicular and then a continuous e parallel, for example, at the same time at the interface. And so effectively you'd pick a anisotropic dielectric tensor that's consistent with the angle of the interface in each of these grid regions. And so this can accommodate even like, ellipsoidal structures, like in many of them. And so you see, if you basically do no smoothing at all, the error is relatively large. And then there are certain methods that can make it even worse, like taking the mean epsilon. So that's not really recommended either, right? So like the error here is like getting up to like maybe 5% at modest resolution. So that's like a huge error. So that's not good. So basically like the method that MEEP is using gets you down below like 0.1% error for a structure like this, even at like a resolution of 20 pixels per period. And period is kind of defined as the distance between these things. Okay. And so you can see that it kind of converges quadratically in the resolution. And so then this is what I meant when I said accuracy goes as like 1 over delta t squared, or like goes as, the error goes as 1 over resolution squared. That's another way to put it. So does that answer your question from earlier, by the way? Okay. Okay, so in terms of symmetrization, yeah, I'm really running out of time here. So basically the idea here is that if you have some structure with a certain symmetry, then you can basically tell MEEP that the symmetry exists, and then it will basically allow you to reconstruct the fields in this region based on this symmetry. Okay, so that's the whole point of this, without going into all the details. You can read the paper if you want to see more. and then this is like an example of the interface. And I'm not going to like go into all the details today, but we'll probably talk about it more next time. Like, how does this interface work? This is all in Scheme. And Scheme is kind of similar to Lisp, if you've ever seen that before. So it's like a kind of a Lisp-based programming language, which is scripted. Okay. And then I think because of time, I'll probably deal with this next time, but you can use this to simulate like light trapping in solar cells, you know? So I'll talk about that and then talk about how MEEP can be used for this application later. Okay. So thanks for your time.